Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, live from the studios of 103.2 Dublin City FM here in Dublin City. I'm really looking forward to today's show and the guests we have lined up certainly are heavyweights in their own particular field. In What's It All About? Today we're going to be talking about the sun, in particular solar flares. These, you might have seen these flares that come up off the sun, very powerful, and spit out protons into space. Well, the sun has been very active this week and I'll be discussing what's going on with Peter Gallagher. He's a leading solar physicist based at TCD. In The Question Is, we'll be on astronomy again, talking about one of the great riddles of astronomy. This is the fact that a lot of the matter, or the vast majority of the matter in the universe, we can't see it. So this dark matter, what's its nature, what's it made up of, why can't we see it? And how does it impact on our understanding of the universe? Well, I'll be talking to Paul Callanan. He's a physics lecturer at UCC about that. And in the writer's room this week, where we talk to authors of science and nature type books, we'll be talking this week to Christian Girondeau. Well, he's a former advisor to the French Prime Minister, and he's written a book, very provocative title, called Climate, the Great Delusion, which questions a lot of the scientific evidence for climate change. But first up today, I have Paul Callanan on the line from UCC. And as I mentioned, we're just going to discuss this very interesting topic of dark matter. So welcome to the programme, Paul.
Thanks very much, Sean. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. First of all, I should say, I should give a plug to your lecture. There's a great series. We're in Dublin, of course, but people can listen on podcasts afterwards. There's a series of lectures. They're public outreach lectures, I guess, to try and promote science, to popularise science. And you're going to be talking, I suppose, in general about the understanding of the universe and this whole area of dark matter, etc. So for somebody who has no idea of dark matter, or this the first time they've heard about it, what exactly is it, and why is it important for astronomers?
Well, I suppose I might start off by saying that if you don't know anything about dark matter, and in particular dark energy, you probably know as much about it as most astronomers do.
Okay.
Because we know that it's there. We know that both dark matter is there and dark energy is there. But aside from that, we have extremely little information as to what either of those things actually are.
Okay, well, maybe I should ask you first and foremost. I mean, we tend to try and understand the world through our eyes, of course.
Exactly.
But, you know, also I'm thinking of, the spectrum that we see in. Of course, there's a lot of ultraviolet light that we can't see. There's a visible spectrum. So, again, there's things going on all around us that we're just not aware of.
Yes, exactly. I mean, certainly from the point of view of astronomy, the primary means that we have of finding out what's out there is to measure the radiation coming from it. And that radiation can be optical radiation, the kind of radiation, the light that's going into your eye right now, or in the infrared or the ultraviolet or the radio and the X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is that to study anything in space, we need to be able to detect the radiation from it.
Okay.
But about 50 years ago or so, some astronomers noted that there seems to be some places in space where, although they couldn't see matter directly from any radiation coming from it, they could infer indirectly that the matter was there.
Mm.
And the primary means they had for doing that was to look for the gravitational pull of this kind of unseen or dark matter on other objects that we could actually see directly.
Okay, so just maybe to explain that, say, our solar system with the planets around the sun, they're all held together in orbit by gravity, aren't
exactly.
they? Exactly. So gravity, you seem to be saying that gravity would expect that there's more matter out there that we can't see.
Well, I mean, one example of the kind of observations people were able to do was to look at distant galaxies. And it turns out that we can measure how quickly the stars and clouds of gas are spiraling around or orbiting around these galaxies. And by doing that, we can figure out the amount of mass in the galaxy that must be putting on the star, let's say,
okay.
to make it travel as quickly as we observe it to move.
Mm-hmm.
And what people found was that the amount of mass required to make these objects move as quickly as we were measuring them was actually much more than what we could see directly.
That must have been a big shock, I suppose, for the science community at the time.
It was a huge shock for the science community. And like all of these things, they start off in a relatively low-level way, when they're first announced, and people talk to other people and they try to decide, you know, is this person, for example, who's telling us this, are they reliable? Are their measurements reliable? And over time, of course, other people start trying to make similar measurements and either crediting or discrediting the original discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very obvious very soon that, in fact, this dark matter wasn't going to go away.
Right, and there's quite, sorry,
real
Paul,
problem. Yes.
But there's is it true that something like 90% plus is this dark matter we can't see?
Well, it depends on where we, it appears to depend on where we look.
Mm.
One place where there seems to be a lot of this dark matter is surrounding galaxies.
Mm.
And in that case, there seems to be between maybe 5 to 10 times more mass that is dark matter, dark stuff that we can't see, than there is the visible matter, you know, from that, stars and things like that, that we can see. When we look at even larger scales, if we look at clusters of galaxies, it turns out that in kind of the very largest scales of the universe, you can have galaxies that are kind of bound together and kind of orbiting around each other, if you will.
Mm.
And we can do the same trick there. We can measure how quickly these entire galaxies are moving in space and figure out the amount of mass that must be present in these systems to keep these galaxies from flying off into the rest of the universe.
Okay.
And again, the amount of mass there is maybe in some of these cases several hundred times greater than the mass that we can see directly. And so the amount of dark matter relative to matter that we can see seems to vary depending on where we look.
Right.
But in any case, it's a very, very significant constituent of the whole universe. And frustratingly, we have very little information about what it could actually be.
I guess whoever finds out more about this is definitely due a Nobel Prize.
I think that's very, very true, definitely.
But, I mean, as far as we know then, what's your I'll just give the title of your talk before
yes.
I forget. And it's on the 23rd of February.
Yes.
And it's in UCC. And it's Whistling in the Dark, How Our Understanding of the Universe Continues to Be Frustrated by the Mysteries of Dark Matter and Dark Energy.
Exactly.
And I think that's up on the web afterwards.
That's right.
So you've presented the mystery. So what's your idea? You're a scientist. What are your theories?
Well, as far as dark matter is concerned, I mean, we have to come up with some kind of matter that is about maybe five or six times more prevalent on average than the matter that we can see directly.
Mm.
And whatever it is some kind of matter that hardly interacts with light or radiation at all. And there have been a few kind of theories for maybe some kind of special particle that could have some kind of mass associated with it, but would hardly interact with any kind of radiation, these so-called WIMPs, these weakly interactive massive kind of particles.
Okay.
And if we can find some evidence from these, and maybe it's possible that some... And that in CERN, in some of these big particle accelerators in CERN, that there may be some new evidence found eventually for these special particles, then that may put us on the track to explaining this mystery of dark matter.
Okay, well, we'll keep some of the mystery for your talk anyway.
That's
sorry,
fine.
we've just run out of time.
Okay,
It's a fascinating area, and you know, I'm going to definitely try and find out more.
Definitely, because I should just finish up, Sean,
sure.
by saying that although dark matter is a mystery in itself, this whole issue of dark energy is an even bigger mystery.
Okay, well,
and
maybe...
in fact, most of the universe, it turns out that the best part of 3/4 of the universe is made of this dark energy, and only a fifth of it dark matter, and only maybe 4% of it is stuff that we can actually see.
Right, so we don't know very much at all. I'm definitely going to have you...
That's a good summary, absolutely.
have you on again to talk
It'll
about
be a
dark,
pleasure,
dark
a pleasure,
energy,
Tom.
And thanks very much for coming on, albeit a bit briefly. That's
Paul
Callanan. He's based at UCC, sorry, and he's going to be talking about the mysteries of dark matter and dark energy on February 23rd there at 8 p.m. Thanks, Paul.
A pleasure. Thanks, Sean.
Okay, now just while we're getting our next guest, did you see this week, just an item of science news, did you ever wonder, I've often thought this myself, why, say, for example, ordinary Germans allowed themselves to be caught up during the Hitler era and seemed to go against their better nature and support them? Or maybe why the producers of TV shows in the US always seem to have laugh tracks attached to their audio recordings? Or even why, say, in Ireland, senior politicians might say something that sounds very plausible, though that you know, according to their record and what they've done in office, that they're anything but plausible. Well, these and other kind of fascinating and slightly disturbing questions about humans and how we're more susceptible than perhaps we'd like to think we are, come out in a new book by a guy called Kevin Dutton, D-U-T-T-O-N, and it's called Split Second Persuasion, The Ancient Art and New Science of Changing Minds. There was a review of that by John Horgan in the Scientific American this week. And just to mention one fascinating thing there, there's lots of interesting things, but one fascinating thing in the 1960s they did that he mentions in the book, 25% of people agreed to administer potentially lethal electric shocks to strangers when they were just ordered to do so by technicians in jeans and t-shirts. And even worse, 65% of people agreed to do it, to administer these shocks if they were told to do it by professors in white coats. So, you know, that says a lot about who we believe and what we're prepared to do. But we're going to move on now anyway, and we're going to continue on the astronomy theme, and we're going to talk about the sun and solar flares, and there's some solar flare activity going on in the last week or so, and it's continuing. And to talk about this, I'm delighted to welcome Peter Gallagher. He's a solar physicist from astrophysicist from TCD. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon. How are you doing, Sean?
Great. Thanks for coming on. So maybe first of all, before we get into the activity, the solar flare activity, could you explain to our listeners what is a solar flare and how does it occur?
Oh, well, a solar flare is an intense burst of radiation from the surface of the sun, and they occur in areas on the sun called sunspots. Mm-hmm. Sunspots are intense concentrations of magnetic fields where you can build up energy by the twisting and churning of the sun's surface. And then when you store all of that energy, it eventually just reaches some limit and pops and spews out all of this hot gas into space. And that spewing out process then is called a solar flare.
Would it be the same as a solar storm? Are they the same things, or are they different?
Well, there's kind of a couple of different solar flares. There's some that are called failed solar flares, and those ones, the sun's gravity pulls them back down onto the surface of the sun, so they don't become solar storms. But the ones that are really energetic then can fling material off the surface of the sun, and once they get into space, they're then called a solar storm.
Okay, so maybe bring us up to date then and tell us what's been going on in the last period. I believe there was a big solar flare or storm on Monday, was it, or Tuesday of this week?
Tuesday morning. Well, the sun has been really, really quiet over the past 5 years or so. There's been nothing going on, and in fact, solar physicists were thinking that the sun had turned off and that we'd entered a great minimum of solar activity, and then that got climate modellers and the like interested, thinking, well, if the sun is turned off, then the atmosphere of the Earth isn't being heated as much, and so, you know, maybe we're going to go through a mini ice age at some point. But this week, the sun seems to have turned a corner and has popped off some of the biggest flares in the past 5 years. So on Tuesday at 2 a.m., an X-class flare occurred. An X-class flare is the biggest flare that you can get. Came from a sunspot and flung lots of hot gas, electrons and protons and the like, straight out into space. And some of them have hit the Earth's atmosphere already and are beginning to produce things like the Northern Lights. So we're beginning to see some spectacular aurora, and that's really the first time in quite a few years that we've seen any auroral activity.
And I should tell people that you're the type of guy that goes in the morning and you check to see if there's been solar activity first thing, I think.
Only that, I get text messages on my phone that tell me when a solar flare has happened.
Right, so you probably knew about it when you were at home then, before you went in.
I sure did, yeah. The phone went and I got a text message, an automatic text message telling me that an X-class flare. So that really must be one of the nerdiest text messages that you can get.
It's exciting stuff anyway.
But no, first thing in the morning, you know, we come in and we look at the sun and see what's on the surface of the sun and see if there's been any activity. And one of our jobs in our group is, you know, in my research group in Trinity, is to monitor solar activity and then make forecasts of what's going to happen, which is a difficult job. But
sure,
we use physical models to try and work out what's going to happen and when.
And that's information that feeds out all over the world, isn't it? It's not just European, even. It goes to the, is it NASA that you would predict for and other people?
Yes, well, we would do forecasting for many different agencies. There are several thousand people on our email lists, and they range from people in NASA to people in the European Space Agency to university researchers, right the way through to telecommunications companies who are keeping an eye on what's going on in solar conditions. So there's a huge spectrum of different types of users, and right the way through to the general public as well, who want to see when the next aurora is going to be.
Sure. And at this point, there may be people listening, why should we care about a solar flare? But actually, there are, say with a big one like this, there are impacts here on Earth that can put us all out.
Yeah. In fact, it was known, even the first transatlantic cable that went across from Valencia to Newfoundland. The operators of that telegraph cable even noticed back then that that there would be fluctuations in the current on the cable, and those fluctuations, those changes, came when sunspots were high.
Did they make the connection back then?
It's funny. They were beginning to, and Kelvin, who was president of the Royal Society in the UK at the time, said, "It's all bunk. I don't believe a word of this, and people shouldn't be, working on this. And there can't possibly be a connection between the sun and the earth." So he was wrong, and there was a provost at Trinity at the time called Lloyd, and he actually built a magnetic observatory in the grounds of the college and measured the effects on the Earth's magnetic field of solar activity back in the 1860s. So there was work even being done back then.
That's fascinating. But now we know that it does impact on, satellites first and foremost, I guess, could get it, and telecommunications or mobile phones or what else? I mean, has there been anything happening this week, for example, that you've heard about?
Well, the solar storm that went off on Tuesday morning hasn't hit the Earth yet.
Okay.
The forecast is for it to hit sometime this afternoon.
Right.
And just before I came on the radio there, I went and looked, and there's nothing at Earth as yet. So over the next, I'd say, 12 hours, that solar storm should hit the Earth. So the forecasts are kind of accurate to within half a day or something, so that's as good as we can get at the moment.
Right.
But there should be something hitting over the next 12 hours. There's a variety of impacts that it could possibly have, and it's very difficult to say how detrimental a solar storm is going to be.
Sure.
But in the worst case scenario, it can knock out communication satellites. And in fact, turn them off. It can ruin the electronics on board a telecommunications spacecraft. But for high frequency communications that you would use, say for communication with an airliner, with a plane, they can be affected as well, and they can get blackouts for up to 10 minutes, and not be able to communicate. And navigation systems can also be affected. So people in the military are particularly interested in space weather effects. Because they need to maintain communications and also have good knowledge of where they are.
Does this mean that that out in Dublin Airport they'd be aware of this? I presume that they might actually shut down the airport if it was.
I wouldn't expect that. I mean, the systems that are in place are robust, so I wouldn't suggest that would happen. But if you look, Shannon has a control center that communicates with aircraft as they go out across the Atlantic, and they keep an eye on what the Earth's upper atmosphere, the ionosphere, is doing, and they change the frequency that they're going to communicate with planes with, based on the way the ionosphere is changing, and the ionosphere is affected directly by the sun. So so they keep an eye on these things, and they change the way they communicate based on that. But it's nothing to worry about. These are ongoing phenomena that engineers and scientists know how to deal with.
Okay, Peter, we just run out of time, but listen, thanks very much for coming on, telling us about solar flares and your work there in Trinity.
You're very welcome. Observing
the sun. Thanks. That's Peter Gallagher. He's a solar physicist based in Trinity College Dublin, telling us about a big solar storm, solar flare that hit earlier this week. That came from the sun, but it's due to hit today and tomorrow here on Earth. So just while we're getting our final guest ready, new slot 2050, I call it, where we take a look into the future, say a snapshot into the future, and we look at certain things that are happening that might impact on that. Well, I noticed this week, the European Space Agency launched its Johannes Kepler space freighter into space. This is a huge thing. It's a 20,000-ton space freighter at launch, which is the biggest payload ever, and its job basically is to supply the International Space Station with air, food, fuel and equipment. Now, the reason why I thought this was interesting, because this freighter is being called in some quarters a space truck, as it could be the forerunner of future space trucks that will carry supplies to astronauts residing on the moon, on Mars or wherever. And the European Space Agency is considering developing a fleet. Now, this is just under consideration, that will be capable of travelling back and forth from the Earth to wherever, the moon, say, with an astronaut driver being used rather than the vehicle being used on a once-off basis, as often happens with space exploration. So I just thought, from an Irish point of view, if we had an Irish astronaut, could he put in a request, if he was on the moon, for the driver to come back with some Galtee rashers, perhaps? Well, okay, now we'll just move on to our last item today in the writer's room. We're going to talk about a book, quite a provocative book, I thought. The title is The Climate, The Great Delusion. Of course, we hear an awful lot about climate change and the evidence for it. I thought it'd be nice or interesting to look at the other side of things. The author of this book is Christian Girandoux, and he was an advisor to the French Prime Minister, Jacques Chaban-Delmas, and hopefully I have him on the line. Hello, Christian.
Hello, how are you?
Thanks very much for coming on our show. Maybe first and foremost, you could tell us, why did you decide to write a book on climate, The Great Delusion? What was your motivating impulse?
Well, I've been, my background is about transportation. So I heard a lot about CO2 emissions from cars, but also from planes and from other sources. And that was the beginning of the story. And then I found something very surprising, is that everyone says, okay, we have to reduce our emissions. But the question is, can we reduce them? And of course, we think, okay, we can have a car which will be smaller, and that would be nice, and so on. But the real answer is that we cannot reduce emission on a worldwide scale. Mm-hmm. It's just impossible. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why I wrote this book, and maybe I can explain why it's impossible.
Sure. Well, let's explain to listeners why you think this is. Emission means carbon dioxide, which is usually from the burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas. So you think that it's going to be very hard to reduce that.
It's not hard. It will be impossible. Just think a minute about it. If you want to reduce emissions, let us say from oil, what are we to do? We have to leave oil on the ground. Mm. As soon as we will use, we are boring a number of wells to find more oil. The only way to reduce emissions will be not to use oil, mm-hmm. gas, and coal. Is this realistic? It's obviously not realistic.
No.
We need these products, and if we are not going, let us say, in Ireland or in France or in Europe to use them, what will happen? The Chinese will use them, or the Indian, because it's not realistic to believe 1 minute that we will be able to leave underground oil, gas, and coal without using them. And as soon as we will use them, there will be CO2 emissions. So it's very funny. It's a very funny story.
And in you mentioned, of course, that it's probably unfair in Europe and in the West generally to say to developing countries like India, perhaps, not to use their reserves because they're at an earlier stage of their development.
Well, in India, because you speak about India, there are 400 million people without electricity.
Mm.
How are you going to explain them? They will have to stay this way. Of course they need electricity. It's a matter of death or life. So what are they going to do? They are going to build power plants. And how are these power plants working? They are working with coal or with gas. And so what we say is absolutely useless. And the Chinese, it's the same story. They are building each week one or two coal power plants the size of nuclear power plants each week. And so, obviously, they will use coal, then they will produce CO2. So it's a delusion to believe that we will be able to reduce CO2 emissions. And all the money in the Western countries we are spending is absolutely wasted.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, the oil, the gas, and the coal, which is underground today, is going to be used.
So do you think, we're a science program, do you think the money going into research on climate change then is a waste? Should they be looking at other problems?
Well, it depends, you know. Of course, it's better to isolate your house. Your bill will be reduced. And if it's economically viable, you have to do this. And another story that you have to prepare to the day, maybe in 30 or 50 years, I don't know, where oil, gas, and coal will be missing. But believing you, if you do that, that you are going to reduce CO2 emissions is just wrong. As long as we will use oil, gas, and coal, we will produce CO2. There is absolutely no way to avoid that.
Okay, well, I'm sorry I can't give this subject more time, but thanks for coming on, and certainly I'm sure people can find your book here in Ireland. It's called Climate, the Great Delusion, and it's written by Christian Girondeau. Hope I have the pronunciation correct.
No, this time it's perfect.
Okay, okay. Well, thank you very much, Christian, for taking our call.
No, it was a pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. That's all we've time for this week. Thanks for listening again, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear more from Science Spinning, please visit the site Science Spin. That's just spin, not spinning. sciencespin.podomatic.com. All shows that I've done are up there now. I think there's about 50 plus of them, and they can be searched by guests or by topic. Also, another place you might go if you're interested in what's happening in science in Ireland is sciencespin.com. That's the magazine Science Spin. You can just sign up with your email there, and you can get 6 issues delivered to your inbox free every year. And finally, if there's anyone out there that'd like to get in touch, I'd be delighted to hear from your feedback. And you can contact me here directly at the show at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie, sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. So thanks again for listening, and bye-bye for now.